The Dow up over 200 points. The Dow's always up when Steve Alexander is manning the business desk, so I'm not surprised by that at all. We'll hear from Steve coming up later in the hour. Also, Elise Glink comes by on Thursdays, and one of the things that I want to talk, well, a couple of things I want to talk to her about. One is I saw a story from a credit union organization, and they say that they are doing very well when it comes to dispensing credit when compared to banks, that they're continue to make inroads. Elise will talk to us a little bit about that and about who owns your local mall. You'll be there a week from tomorrow, so you might as well know who's owning it and how lucrative is it to own malls in America, not the Mall of America, but malls in America these days. I want to start, though, by talking a little bit about, you know, we talk a lot about crime and different ways to fight crime, but what if the idea of helping crime victims was actually a way to reduce crime? That's one of the things that's jumped out at me from this new group called Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice. And Shakira Diaz joins us on the phone line now. Shakira, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me. So glad to be on.
Pleasure. I'm glad that you are. Now, you know, this is a business show, and so we talk about, obviously, crime and the idea of fostering positive communities and businesses and things such as that. But tell me about this idea that treating crime victims in a better way, dealing with their trauma, their ordeal, might actually help reduce crime down the road.
Sure. Well, let me start off with just indicating that, you know, we're really happy to be on. The Alliance for Safety and Justice has launched Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, and it's a national network that gives crime survivors a voice in public policy that brings them to the center of the conversation. You know, for several decades, you just mentioned you talk about it on the show, but for several decades, the criminal justice rhetoric that's been out there hasn't matched the policy reality, and crime survivors' needs have not been met. So our group, our organization, Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, which is a flagship project of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, recognizes that crime survivors deserve a justice system.
Okay, I'm on page with you. I'm with you there. But, you know, I think a lot of times when we think of crime victims, we think of a suburban mom who was mugged in the mall or something like that. We don't think about the people who are most likely to be crime victims. And those are, you know, poor people in the inner city. And those people then are susceptible to creating crime if their ordeal isn't dealt with. That's what I want you to talk to me about. Explain that for me.
Sure. You're right on that. You know, we have overlooked for several decades the true picture of who is a victim of a crime. The reality is that those communities that are most harmed, least helped, are those people that you're talking about. They're folks who are living in communities who may be vulnerable to victimization. And studies actually show that 8 to 10 victims of crime experience at least one symptom of trauma, which leads to a number of other problems. So I'll outline that really quickly. Addiction is a problem that's connected to trauma, unaddressed trauma, housing instability, mental health issues. And as a result, crime victims are at a higher risk of repeat victimization and behaviors that lead to crime itself.
So if you are if you're a certain victim of a crime, that actually might increase the possibility that you one day will be a criminal yourself.
Exactly, which is why we're advocating to center crime victims and the healing and prevention of crime.
Tell me about that, Shakira, tell me about that. What would you like to see done? What can we do better to reduce that possibility?
Sure. Well, one model that we promote and support is a trauma recovery center model, which really provides wraparound services and support for crime victims. First and foremost, you know, it helps crime victims on their healing journey and recover from the trauma of their experience. Oftentimes we think about PTSD for just certain demographics, but crime victims are certainly people who experience PTSD and need that support in recovering from that trauma. But these trauma recovery centers, in addition to providing that counseling and support, they also provide wraparound services to help crime victims navigate all these different systems. And, you know, an example could be, you know, a parent loses their eldest child to violence. Well, that parent is struggling to just cope with like their own trauma, and if they have other children, you know, they may not be equipped to have that conversation with their other children or their children's school. In addition to that, navigating the court system. So it's really overwhelming, and we put a lot on crime victims. The idea here is to help crime survivors, crime victims, and lifting that load and helping them get over on the other side.
Shakira Diaz is the managing director for the Alliance of Safety and Justice. She is with the Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice Committee. Thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure, and I'd urge folks who are interested to visit our website at crimesurvivorsforsafetyandjustice.org.
It's a good idea. All right, Bill Geiger of Geiger Wealth Management in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Nice to be here, sir.
So, you know, coming in, I was thinking this morning, like, well, the Dow has been on its way down a little bit lately, and I know what Geiger's going to talk about. It doesn't last forever, and here we are today. It's kind of a positive day.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't be fooled day to day, right?
Well, yeah, you shouldn't. And if you're getting close to retirement, you should kind of sort of be looking over things.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go back a little bit when you're starting to get ready for retirement.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people, it's one of those things where they know they should be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get started?
Well, and you're right. A lot of people know they kind of sort of should be doing something.
It's one of those things that just kind of hangs over you.
But they don't know where to start. And we talk to people all the time like that in our offices. And basically we help them put together a conceptual idea of what they should be doing at this stage of their life. You know, your late 50s, early 60s, your portfolio really shouldn't look like a 30-year-old's anymore.
Right, right.
And the really big deal, and if there's anything that you cannot get wrong in planning for retirement, this is it. You better make sure that you're putting together some sort of a plan for how you're going to pay your bills for the next 20 to 30 years. Where are you going to get that source of income from?
And that's one of the keys, really, because you always say talk about the happiest retiree. It's the guy with the pension, right? He knows something's coming in.
And how easy our parents had it. You know, they had pensions, they had bonds and CDs paying 8%, and we don't have that anymore.
No, we do not.
you've got to put together your own plan for that income, and it can't just be, I want my money to grow as much as possible and then pick at it for
a while.
Right, right. You got to have dependable, sustainable income.
All right, so do you have I know that you talk about moving toward the income when you're in your 50s or 60s, but if you're in your 20s or 30s, do you develop a plan then? With an eye toward income later?
No, your job in your 20s and 30s is just to save as much as humanly possible. That's the key. It's not finding a hot stock or a hot mutual fund. It's saving money. But when you get in your late 50s to early 60s, that's when you start need to changing things around.
Well, the Dow and the stock market's been on a pretty remarkable run.
Right.
We're due for a correction, right? It's been 8 years, almost
yes,
9 years.
Has.
So is this? Why would this be a better time than, say, another to take action?
It's a better time to take action now than when the Dow is cut in half.
Right.
Right, because you've got more money. I mean, that's kind of obvious. We sat down with a couple, 60-year-old couple. This is a great example. The guy's 401k plan had hit $800,000. And he's happy as a lark, but he was really, really worried about it going in the other direction. And we put that $800,000 into an income strategy. These folks are going to retire at 67 in 7 years. They're going to have over $70,000 a month guaranteed for the rest of their life. Over 25 years of retirement, they'll pull out of that income strategy $1.7 million.
That's with starting with $800,000?
Starting with $800,000. And they'll still have $1 million left in their portfolio. Pretty amazing numbers.
Yeah, that's pretty.
Yeah, and that's
I'm
that's
sitting
nirvana.
With my jaw open. I want to be there.
That's nirvana. You want that part of your portfolio to continue to grow, even if it's a tad, but you want to be able to draw a lot of income that you can depend upon.
So you can get to your 401k at 59, right?
59 and a half.
All right, and so what do you suggest? I mean, you know, it's kind of tempting. It's right there.
If you're 59 and a half, one of the problems with 401k plans is there's not a, a,
a lot of choices.
Not a lot of choices, and they all involve risk to one degree or another. If you're 59 and a half, a lot of people don't know this, Steve. You can roll your 401k plan into an IRA, still continue working, still continue participating in your plan, and once the money's in your IRA, you can do something like this income strategy we were talking about.
So the idea then, if you take it out of your 401k, put it in an IRA, you're still putting it in a place where it's working for you.
It's working for you, but you can protect it and you can create income for it. I know you're going to talk about this in a moment, and this is maybe a good time to help lead into this. For the next five callers with at least $500,000 in their portfolio, we're going to do something special for them, a full-blown retirement plan on a complimentary basis.
Great. And well, you got me thinking now. I got to get to that nut, and I want $70,000 a month.
Amen.
We sit on a Thursday afternoon in the Allstate Showcase Studio along a brisk Michigan Avenue, people walking up and down about a week from today. Well, a week from today, it'll probably be pretty quiet. And then a week from tomorrow, a very different story. Ian Scherer is coming to Chicago just to shop on Michigan Avenue on Black Friday. But first, he joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Ian, how are you, friend?
I'm doing all right. I actually have shopped on Michigan Avenue, and I've been away from Michigan Avenue as well. I love coming to Chicago when I can, but unfortunately not this week.
Yeah, I know. You come to Chicago and you sit down with Mayor Emanuel. I've seen how that works. I've seen your reporting.
Yes. No. Hey, I was very thankful that he spent some time talking to us, and it was a very fun story. You know, there's some really interesting tech stuff going on in Chicago.
Hey, I'm fascinated by this digital pill story, and I got to tell you, I saw it first earlier this week and didn't pay too much attention to it. I'm like, whatever. I read it a little bit more today, and this could have a real impact on people who need it. Explain it for me.
Yeah, it's a really cool idea. So what it is that there's this little sensor in the pill, and you eat it along with the pill. It's just going to pass through you, so don't worry. And what it does is that it sends a message to a wearable patch that you're wearing on your arm or whatever that then talks to your phone. And what it's able to do is tell your doctor or your family or really whomever that you took your pill and you either did it on time or not because your phone knows when you're supposed to do it. And think about how incredibly powerful this could be for people like Alzheimer's patients who, you know, are trying to maybe still live an independent life and they need to take a regular heart medication or whatever. And, you know, I've been through this. My mother had Alzheimer's, and I wanted to know, like, okay, if I could know that she's at least taking her medication regularly, I would feel so much more comfortable about her being on her own. And so that's really where this could have some serious power. Other stuff is like doctors who need to make sure their patients are taking, you know, their health medications or whatever.
Well, that's
really good way to keep people in mind.
Ian, that's what jumped out at me was that dealing with patients who have schizophrenia or maybe severe depression or things like that. I think that's where it's being experimented with right now.
At the moment, that's where they're focused. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and that's
so much more.
And it's important that a lot of those patients take their medications. I think sometimes some of them don't want to, so they, you know, might say that they're not. And this is just a way for their caregivers, whether it's a doctor or family member, just to prove that it is or is not happening. So how far are we from this becoming, I'm going to say widely acceptable, but at least available?
I think we're going to see this happen a lot quicker than you think. You know, now that it's gotten past the FDA approval, you're going to start seeing this stuff happening pretty quick, I think.
Is it expensive?
What's going to be interesting, huh?
Is it expensive?
It's going to add to price, definitely. Every time you add a sensor, it costs more. I mean, I had to buy a $5 card to be able to go in and out of the subway without having to, you know, buy a ticket every time. So they're going to add some sort of cost to the tablets, but the value is very high, and what will be interesting to see is that if the hospitals and the doctors feel like that this is actually saving them money because people are taking their medications more often, they're not going to the ER as much, all that, then there actually may not be an extra cost for you and me because it actually
good
costs
point.
Them less over time.
You know, I'm just thinking of different ways that would be used, and if, you know, because you sign it up and you can have someone, your daughter or son or whomever, have access to it through this portal. It could also be just a warning sign that something bad is going on if the person hasn't taken their pill in 6 hours. Someone might have fallen or something like that. So, wow, pretty interesting sort of development. And I got to tell you, I sort of blew it off when I first saw it. And now I'm really excited about it. I like this idea a lot.
Well, as someone who takes a medication every day, I sometimes sit there and I'm like, did I take it? And I can't take it twice. And so...
Oh, well, that's a good point.
Those are times where it could be really helpful even for normal people.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'd have a little scratch pad and paper by your bed there. That'll help you, Ian, for now, until we get the digital pill for you.
Thank you.
I'll send you one. Hey, the holidays are coming up.
There you go.
Okay, I never pay attention to what browser I'm using. I just don't. And anytime here at work, if there's a computer problem, the IT guys, you know, Art or Jim, they'll say, well, we're using Chrome? And like... No. Oh, you should use Chrome. It's like, oh, were you using Firefox? No. Oh, you should use Firefox. I think it's their excuse. So, and now there's this Firefox Quantum, which is out. And should I care about this?
Well, you should care. It's up to you whether you want to try it. The idea is that, you know, Firefox, first off, if you remember, 2004, really was the first independent browser to come out to fight up against Internet Explorer, right? During that time, Internet Explorer for Microsoft, it was default in Windows. You know, the whole Netscape thing had happened, and all of the world pretty much ran on Internet Explorer, which ended up being a huge security problem. So Firefox came out. It caused this whole wave of new stuff from Chrome. Apple has one called Safari. There's just all of these ones out there. And so now Firefox is trying to – they really fell behind because Chrome was so much faster. It got people kind of connected to Google services better and all that. So Firefox is trying to focus on speed. That's one of the things. They think they're much faster than everyone else, they say, and security. You know, they say they're going to protect your data, which is something that in this day and age is very, very key. So it's going to be interesting to see whether it actually succeeds at all this stuff and whether or not it moves the needle in people being interested.
All right. So is this a conscious decision for you what browser you use?
It is. I actually think a lot about this because I'm a nerd of the highest order and I need to, you know, this is what I spend my time on. But, you know, look, I use Safari on my computer because I have an Apple computer. And for the most part, I find that Apple really did a good job with its battery life. And so when I'm using Safari, I get way better battery life than Chrome. And that's the thing. Every browser has different valuable stuff it does. If you're using Google stuff all the time, Gmail, Google Docs, then you're going to want to use Chrome because it's just built for that. If you are worried about your security and privacy, Firefox is maybe the answer. And if you want battery life that's just second to none, you're using Safari. But here at CNET, for example, we don't say which one is the best. We just say which ones have the best value for whatever you need.
Right,
and
so,
that's, I think, where we are right now.
Well, go ahead and tell me which one is the best.
Well, that's the problem. I couldn't tell you.
Okay, so...
It really depends on what you need it for.
So I use Firefox, I think, for the most part. So I should go home and download this or upgrade or update to the Quantum?
Absolutely, you should. Yes, especially if you're a Firefox user. There is no reason you should not do this. It's doubling your speed as you're using it, and there's just only benefit to it. And they've been working on it a long time. We actually have a really... fascinating story that we wrote a couple of months ago with link to in on CNET that actually digs into how they developed it and why they did it this way. And it's really fascinating what they went through to do that.
Okay, we got about a minute left, and there's a story you guys are running about how, and this fascinates me too. There's a family, I think they're in Staten Island or somewhere, where the young child was able to unlock his mom's phone with his face. And
yeah, so you know the iPhone 10 has this great face unlock thing, right? And
right.
It's supposed to be super secure and super reliable and better than the fingerprint sensor. So it turns out that for kids who are under the age of 13 who look very similar to their parents,
because their faces haven't developed yet. That's so cool to
me.
So kids under 13, their faces aren't fully developed, so they look a lot more like their parents than they will when they're older.
Yep, and I haven't tested it with my 1.5-year-old. I think he probably wouldn't be able to do it, but
right. We
do look very similar. And so I'm curious to see what it's going to be like in a few years. But Apple says this isn't that big a deal because, again, it's something they actually were aware of before. And it's, you know, it's just hope that your kid doesn't grow up to work for the NSA and rat you out.
And so then I read later in the piece about the probabilities, and they say that the chance of someone else, a random person, unlocking your phone is about a 1 in 1,000,000 for Face ID. And then I thought the thumbprint was completely unique, but they say for that, it's 1 in 50,000 that someone else could have a similar thumbprint enough to turn on your phone.
Right, and that's part of why Apple got rid of the fingerprint sensor and just went straight to the face unlock, is that they said, look, this is so much more secure.
1 in 50,000 is pretty remote, but I just was surprised by that. All right, Ian, sure. Listen, now, we won't talk next Thursday, so have a great Thanksgiving, and we'll check in again soon, okay?
All right, take
care.
Hey,
this is your first Thanksgiving with the baby, isn't it?
It is. We're really excited. It's actually, it's our second. He was born last May.
Oh,
the
I'm
first
sorry.
One where he's eating some of the food, so that'll be fun.
Well, not all of it, just some of it.
Yes.
We'll talk again soon. Steve Alexander just gave the business headlines, and I have to admit I was doing something else at the very beginning. So, Steve, I don't know if you had this, but the House has just approved the big tax bill. You did have that.
They did. Party line vote. No Democrats voted for it.
So it now will look at the House, or the Senate, rather, but
yes,
the House has come through with their vote. Mm-hmm. Elise Glink is on a phone line now to talk to us about that and a whole lot more. She's the publisher of ThinkGlink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. That's an HR app for businesses. That's pretty cool. It helps workers sort of gauge how freaked out they are about financial institutions or situations, I should say, and then helps them sort of dial it down a little bit. I don't know. Maybe you're freaked out about institutions, too. Elise, how are you?
Oh, I'm good, thanks. I think everybody's a little freaked out about what tax reform is going to mean to their pocketbook, don't you?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. So it comes through the House. Now, the Senate bill is a lot different because it doesn't have the sort of the restrictions on the SALT write-off, right, the state and local taxes, which is a big deal,
yep,
for people in Illinois, not so much in other states that tend to be more Republican-leaning. But I did a calculator that said I thought for sure I would be paying more in taxes. I did a little calculator that seems to say I'll be paying a little bit less. I don't know if I believe that, but you think I should believe that? Are those calculators pretty reliable?
I don't think that there can be a reliable calculator right now. At least I haven't seen one. And everyone that I've been trying all says that I'm saying I'm going to pay more. And
right,
so I really hope that they're wrong.
Right.
I'm worried about it.
And you're right. Of course you can't trust the calculator because we're looking at two very different bills right now. So how are we going to know what it's going to end up with? And the Senate fight will be a little tougher than the House fight. I mean, we've already got Ron Johnson of Wisconsin saying he is likely to vote no. Now, Johnson's has said things like this before and changed his mind, so we'll see. What do you expect,
yeah,
from the Senate side?
I think it's a much rougher go in the Senate. I think you've got a much closer vote in terms of just on the party line vote. I think that's kind of tough. I also think that throwing in the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, really throws a wrench into a lot of people. And I think that people are starting to wake up, both in, on Capitol Hill and out, to problems that the National Association of Realtors raised in a call yesterday with journalists that I sat in on, where they talked about how it's not just the repeal or elimination or cutting in half of the mortgage interest deduction, which many people think of as sort of this, important golden, moment for homeowners, but they are also changing something that maybe you weren't aware of. So right now, according to tax law, you can sell your home and keep up to $250,000 of profit tax-free. You can do that every 2 years as long as you've lived in your house as a primary residence for two of the last 5 years. That's going to change from 2 years out of 5 years, to 5 out of 8 years. And so that has profound implications.
So wait, you could sell 5 houses in 8 years? Is that what you're saying?
Nope. That is what I'm saying.
Oh.
I'm saying that you have to live in your house as a primary residence for 5 of the last 8 years under the new tax bill. And the realtors are saying that that could, in fact, translate into a 10% drop in the value of your home, up to 30% drop in the value of your home, because it makes it so much less easy for people to move and keep their profits tax-free.
All right, I'm kind of blowing things up because we had other things to talk about, but this is happening right now. I'm not sure I agree with that then, Elise, even though I don't understand it. I'm clear of that. So if the idea of the tax break is to encourage people to live in their homes for a while and to accrue, profit there or money, why isn't it okay to require them to live a little bit longer? I mean, seems to me like the people who would be hurt by this would be the people who are kind of flipping homes.
So you would think that, but if you think about how millennials take jobs and move jobs every 2 to 3 years, and in fact, if you look at our workforce, we no longer are a workforce where everybody stays in a job for 30 years. I mean, you do, and maybe I do, but
yeah, that's a good point.
I hate to say this, we're old by comparison, but if you look at 20-somethings, 30-somethings, and 40-somethings, they tend to jump jobs, and they tend to be very portable, and they move across country. And so when you start to, if you want to encourage people to make the investment to buy in a house and to establish roots in a community, which, by the way, has been part of the tax code the realtors have said for about 100 years, and something that politicians have really, really liked for a long time. Now you're going to get in the way of when they jump jobs or change jobs. I'm not sure that that's going to have the right kind of effect.
They're going to be more inclined. They'll be more inclined to rent at the next spot because they might not be there for 2 years.
Correct. And okay. So then what does that do? So somebody's owning the properties that they're in, but they're also talking about changes to the 1031 exchange, with which investors, real estate investors, depend on, that could have some serious implications, maybe for real estate, for definitely other kinds of investments that people are making. So it's interesting. There are some deeper consequences here that I think aren't getting as much air and light that we should all be aware of.
Well, I'm glad that one got a little light today because you changed my mind. It makes more sense to be on your side than mine on this one. I appreciate that. Go ahead.
I just want people to understand what they're actually voting on so that they, you know, get it. And so, for example, a city like Chicago, where our real estate market, and we talked about this a little last week, our real estate market is dying back a little bit. But in any case, we haven't seen the same kind of price appreciation in so many other parts of the country. If we got hit with another 10 or 15% because they've passed tax reform and we can't write off our mortgages the same way and we have to stay in our homes longer and we can't write off our state taxes and they get rid of the medical deduction and, you know, all these other things that they're talking about, you know, we could see a consequence here that people would be very unfortunate.
Elise Glink, I got to run. Thank you very much. I appreciate that insight.
It's a pleasure.